He was going to landscape a garden that people would tour. And every day that I have Airbnb guests, they tour my partner's garden. A young lady from Singapore who's a photographer spent half of the day Saturday photographing my garden. This is what Airbnb has done to me. All the legalities I don't know about, but I've lived in my house 18 years and I'm getting to keep it today because of Airbnb. Thank you.
Thank you.
That would be, my name is Matt Curtis, and I'm the Government Relations Director for all worldwide governmental relations for HomeAway. We're actually the largest short-term rental company in the world. We have over a million listings around the world in 190 countries. And I'm the guy that actually flies around the world and works with city councils and mayors and city staffs around the world on this issue. There's probably nobody else who has this job or would want it, except I do get to fly around a lot, which is neat. Unfortunately, I do use the Portland story a little bit in my presentations when I do go and speak with other city councils. In July of 2012, I called over the period of 2 days and I spoke with 9 different offices trying to find out what exactly your short-term rental regulation was and could not get clarity from any office. And eventually the clarity I found was folks actually admitting that the regulation was very, it wasn't easy to follow and it wasn't easy to understand. There was a real lack of clarity and the inability for short-term rental owners and operators to be compliant. A cursory review of short-term rental listings in the Portland area found about that the oldest one seemed to be 15 to 20 years old in the area. So you had listings here that have been around for a long time. So when we talked about the unintended consequences, there are folks who probably have been operating as a short-term rental and a traditional short-term rental for 15 or 20 years that might, in the scenario where they're not able to operate anymore, be essentially not able to continue to conduct their business. I was the chief of staff for the former mayor of Austin and the current mayor of Austin and for a council member before that, and we fought a short-term rental regulation there that went on for a two-year-long discussion. It went very, very long, but one of the things we found out is for traditional short-term rentals, the average length of stay is a little bit more. It's 6.8 days. The average party size is 5.1 people. The average nightly stay is $250 a night, and the average age of the party is 44. So basically, I'm sorry, 44 years old. So basically, you have an older group of people, a larger group of people, staying for a longer period of time. And I can probably
keep going. Oh, you've come some distance. We'll give you some extra time.
I appreciate that. What are the kinds of travelers? Well, you know, they tend to be folks. We have 28% have a graduate degree and 36% college degree, 19% with some college degree. This is a guy named Alan Kamen who came to Portland just earlier this year, and he came up here with his 3 adult daughters, stayed at a traditional short-term rental and had a good time while here, and they loved going to Powell's Books, and they had a really good time. But wouldn't be willing to come if he didn't have the opportunity to have that entire home and feel like they were able to be the residents of that entire home. In 2012, the U.S. Conference of Mayors passed a resolution that basically said that the easiest way to create a short-term rental regulation is to make it fair and effective and easy for the owners and the managers to follow it. What's interesting is in 2014, there was a resolution this summer regarding short-term rentals where it urged support to basically include the traditional short-term rental in the regulation. Now, doing a poll in partnership with the Oregon VRMA, we found that 69% of Portlandians actually support traditional short-term rentals as part of the local economy. 67% believe that they should be legal in Portland, and even 60% of those believe that the regulation should be just fair and clear and easy to follow, while 29% feel that the registration program is not even necessary at all. So you actually have a really strong support for the traditional short-term rental community in Portland.
May I just interrupt?
Yes, sir.
Can we assume that 11% favored an unfair and unclear registration program?
It must be so.
And I'm happy to share that poll and the full questions and all the crosstabs of that poll with you as well. The economics, well, you know, an economist not too long ago did a study and found that the entire overall economic impact of the activity is $46.5 million for the entire community, and it benefits the jobs to about 375. This is a guy named Roberto Camarillo who came to Portland back in February, and he stayed with his son and his son's family in Lad's Edition. They were visiting his daughter and his son who just had a new baby, and they already had an existing baby. So the family's house was too small. But they didn't want to stay in a hotel too far away. They wanted to stay in a house, and they wanted to be able to share that whole activity as a family. When we start to look at the economics and the poll and the best practices, we also probably want to talk about where there are some worst practices. In New York, when they banned short-term rentals in 2010, they doubled down on the ban with a heavy fine in 2011. Now there's about four and a half times the number of short-term rentals since before the ban, but they are not able to enforce that ban even with a higher fine in New York. They did the same thing in Palm Desert, California, except Palm Desert came back just a little while later. In about 2008, they actually regulated short-term rentals and allowed traditional short-term rentals to be active in the community. Now they feel they have 100% compliance in Palm Desert, Rancho Mirage, Cathedral City, and other cities in Southern California. So they actually find with a fair and easy and effective registration program, they're actually able to have much higher levels of compliance. So looking at all the regulations around the country, I think while this is a phenomenal step in the right direction from my phone call in July of 2009, call in July of 2012, when I called 9 different offices and was not able to find any kind of an answer about what the registration program was, I think this is a huge step in the right direction to create a registration program and a regulatory atmosphere that works. However, I feel that if we could get the owners and the managers of the traditional short-term rentals to the table, include them to talk about best practices and proven resources, to understand the needs of the traveler, remember Alan who came up here with his daughters, or Roberto, and to have a data-driven conversation with the entire stakeholder, which includes the traditional short-term rental owner and operator, that's when I think you're actually going to find the highest success rate and the greatest amount of compliance. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions. This is somebody who works in the industry.
No, thank you. This is real helpful. So,
all the way here, we hope actually sure. You consider buying a place.
Funny that you say that.
First, since you've done a lot of polling, did you get a sense of whether there was any consensus around a street fee proposal? Was there any one option that sort of – okay. So Austin, in the stuff that we've pulled off the Internet, San Francisco, Austin, and New York come up a lot. So we have the benefit of someone who knows Austin pretty well. So a couple questions. What has been Austin's experience with multifamily?
Well, they just created – so basically they separated the entire regulatory atmosphere into 3 frameworks. If you want to think of it easily, type 1 would be more of somebody renting their apartment or their property, just for the occasional weekend. That was a type 1. Type 2 would be a traditional short-term rental, and type 3 would be multifamily. They only implemented the type 3 multifamily regulation, I believe it was probably March, so it's fairly new. It was just something that actually was left out of the original regulation. What they did do is they have a cap per building that essentially limits the number of short-term rentals that could be in every building. People do have to register and pay a registration fee. I think it's yet to be seen what the success rate of that is.
Success rate in terms of bringing it out from under the shadows, or success rate in terms of this regulatory scheme working?
Well, success rate from this one working, particularly because they created a very high fee. I think if Austin made us one flaw that the council, it's a council manager form of government, the city council really stressed having a very low fee. The city staff implemented a $275 fee for everyone to register. So for your occasional multifamily registrant, that may hamper the registration. I think if you asked most of the council members, they would have said, when they said low, they meant $20.
And, sir, the other question I had, and this has come up in particularly in San Francisco, do you have any initial data on the impact of short-term rentals on the inventory or stock of affordable rental housing?
It's good that you say that. You know, it's interesting. The traditional short-term rentals, so the standalone home that's being rented out as a short-term rental most of the year, we don't see a whole lot of traditional short-term rentals in urban areas. So in Austin, the estimate at any given time is we probably have about 300. In San Francisco, I haven't gauged anyone on the actual number, but it's not a lot. And we're also talking about multi-million dollar properties, very, very expensive homes that have probably been, pied à terre, if you will, you know, people's second homes for a long time. We haven't heard or seen any real data on what that does to the kind of housing stock. But in Austin, Texas, if you think it's the 11th largest city in the United States, 300 homes isn't taking a lot of housing stock off the table. And it seems like in your urban areas, the traditional short-term rental is not a major component of the short-term rental atmosphere, like kind of more of your, you know, occasional short-term rental would be. Did that answer your question?
Good. Thank you. Other questions?
Do you happen to know if Austin addressed the issue of who needs to be notified in multifamily housing?
They did, and they have a neighbor notification. They have an existing notification strategy that works for a variety of zoning and land use issues where the neighbors within a certain distance will get a letter. And in this case, when a when somebody registers for a short-term rental, the neighbors in a certain distance, I want to say it's 100 feet, if I remember correctly, and I'm happy to give that answer for you.
And that applies in multifamily housing?
Yes, I believe it does, and I'll verify that for
Great.
You, but I'm confident that it does.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate you.
This is actually a good time to ask a lot of questions because I'm the one who has to grill over this stuff all the time. It's painful at times. But
well, as we move forward with this, assuming that we're moving forward with all or a portion of this, I think your assistance and other companies that are doing this work will be very helpful. So we appreciate you coming today, getting in touch with us, and two, obviously there's more refinement to do regardless of what we do in the next couple of weeks. So. We hope we can continue to call on you as a resource and make you have to fly back to Portland again.
Please, I'm happy to. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, welcome.
Hi. Thank you for your time today. My name is Cliff Johnson. I'm the co-founder of Vacasa. We're a local vacation rental property management company. We formed the company here in 2009. We manage over 1,000 rentals in 6 states, 135 jurisdictions, none of which are in Portland. One of the reasons we do that is we have strict compliance with local codes and laws. We don't manage homes that are illegal rentals. And one of the things that we see as a common thread that happens is whenever you overregulate rentals or make the ordinance in such a way that it's very difficult to comply with or understand, people just don't do it. And now this happens all over the coast. We manage several homes out on the coast, and there's several different ways of doing it. Cannon Beach has a very restrictive way of doing it. Other places like Petaluma County are very open and obvious what you're supposed to do. There's a low barrier to entry, and people comply with those laws. And so what we're really looking to promote here is, you know, giving the option for people to understand what the law is and how they can comply with that, create a low barrier to entry, and also create enforceability for the law. One of the things I'd also like to focus is the difference between, Matt alluded to, traditional short-term rentals. And a lot of this law that we're looking at now is addressing room shares or atypical vacation rentals. It really isn't addressing, you know, the 3-bedroom and higher homes. And it's somewhat of an arbitrary distinction in the sense that, you know, we're going to allow this activity because we know it's happening, but we're not going to allow the traditional activity. Whereas that's the activity that is very unlikely to be competing with affordable housing. As Matt said, a lot of times they're million-dollar homes. They're snowbirds where they spend 6 months in Portland, 6 months in somewhere else. They want to rent that, and it's going to create a lot of jobs. I mean, we've created 325 jobs in 4 years. 200-plus of those are in Oregon. Several of them in Portland, despite the fact that we can't do business in Portland. And we could create 300-plus if we had the opportunity to manage traditional short-term rentals here.
So maybe a question for both you and Matt. So typically in these other city ordinances, I mean, we have, as you said, we've come into this through the door of what the zoning code allows in single-family neighborhoods, and now we've broadened that a bit, but we're not yet addressing the question of traditional vacation rentals. Is it typical in other cities that they are regulating it? And are there some best practices? Well, you mentioned some, Tillamook County. You know, other best practices we ought to look at because we've not yet opened that door, really, in the regulatory work that we're doing here.
Definitely. I would state Tillamook County, it's a recent ordinance. And a lot of the ones that have done it recently have taken a view where they look at several different cities and take the best practices from each city, what's working really well. Newport just went through this as well, and they did a really great job. They really engaged the community. It took them a little while, but not nearly as long as Lincoln City is taking, and it ended up with a resolution that really has gone well in the city. It's increased their room taxes, and what they had before was similar to Portland, where it was somewhat of an unwritten illegal law. You know, it was you could rent your house 10 times per year. There was really no way of enforcing whether people were renting more than that or less. And as a result, they came up with an ordinance that's very easy to comply with. I mean, it requires an inspection, which is great. I mean, safety is one of our biggest concerns in our homes. We don't want any of our guests getting injured. That's a liability issue for us, too. And that's something I would bring up as well, is this law doesn't really give a place for to develop vacation rental property management companies within Portland. And those companies will help bring people, you know, to the surface, make them comply with the law, make them understand the law. If there's not a place for them, I mean, we're not going to engage in activities so we can rent out a $50 a night room. There's not enough money in that for us, you know, to be frank. But it's also, I don't see the benefit to the community as much as I do bringing in people, visitors that wouldn't come here otherwise, that are going to spend more money. And they're also going to be good visitors. They're going to be families that are, you know, willing to only willing to come here and stay a longer period, like we said, if they have that option. So.
Good. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Matt, other places that you can think of that address this vacation rental by owner kind of situation?
Yeah. Certainly. In Austin and Portland worldwide are really viewed by so many people as best practice communities. I mean, honestly, I come from a neat city, and I'm coming to the neatest city. But seriously.
I like hearing that.
Especially from Austin.
But we are the best practice communities. Everybody is so sick of hearing about Austin and Portland whenever they talk about how to do things from placemaking to transportation and so on. But we do it well, and I think Austin would be a great place to start. I think that unfortunately, because there's probably a lot of small town examples, but that's where a lot of the short term rental activity was happening traditionally. So you would be looking at places like the Coachella Valley towns I mentioned, like Palm Desert. An interesting thing in those conversations is you'll run across a city planner named Cindy Gosselin. Cindy was the one who actually worked to ban the short-term rentals in 2002, I believe it was, in Palm Desert, only to come back and add an extreme high fee for people who are engaging in the activity still in 2005, only to come back in 2008 or 2009 and say, what are we doing? They're obviously still operating just under the radar. Let's build a registration program that's fair and easy to follow. That's been very successful, and she's taken that and replicated that in dozens of cities around the United States. So the Coachella Valley communities, Cindy Gosselin, the city planner there, Austin would probably be some good places to start.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. Very helpful. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Next.
Are Mike Kirk, Eric Schmidt, and Diane Henderson, and they'll be followed by Matthew Tesdall, Betsy LaBarge, and Judy Crockett.
Welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mayor and Commissioners. My name is Michael Kirk. I just wanted to talk about some of the positive impacts, positive financial impacts to the traditional short-term rental industry. This industry generates in cities that are of our size and population of between 40 and 50 million per year in revenue annually. And that taxable revenue could certainly be used to further some of our tourism activities and other city development projects. Traditional short-term rentals generate other revenue for our communities through restaurants, purchasing activities, people visiting our local attractions, the type of things that we want to bring outside visitors into our community and get to know Portland and consider this a place that they want to return on an annual basis, hopefully. Traditional short-term rentals also have another benefit where people are using these properties as their second home. They're paying property taxes on those particular locations, but they're not using a lot of the services that are associated with that, such as schools, the kids that that would be normally living in these properties on a full-time basis if they were the primary resident aren't there. They're in another home, in another place, maybe in another state, but are still paying those fees to help generate money for our schools and other activities. And not using other city resources that would traditionally be in a full-time resident property.
Sir, just on the point you just raised,
yes.
The amendment that's now on the table requires that the owner occupy the home for 9 months of the year. So that would seem to go against what you're saying, the benefits of
sure.
extending this program to second homes that happen to be in Portland.
Sure.
So do you have a comment on that?
No, my misunderstanding of the actual ordinance that we're discussing or the amendment that's on the table. I apologize.
Well, I just wanted to clarify that I was listening to your point.
Sure.
You make an eloquent point, but the amendment on the table would effectively prevent the person that has the second home that they don't occupy that's in Portland. It would prevent them from renting it out for short-term rentals because they can't establish that they are an owner-occupant for 9 months of the year.
Sure. Understood. Okay. Also, wanted to discuss as far as the tourism industry things, as far as our rental inventory for people visiting our community, one of the benefits here is we don't have to build other hotels and things to house potential future tourism coming into our community. We can house them in existing inventory that is participating in some of this traditional short-term rental activity.
You know, I think in your testimony and some of earlier today and also last time sort of demonstrated, I mean, one way to think about this is the old three-door thing. You know, door number one is single-family homes that are renting out rooms. Door number two is multifamily structures, whether they're condos or apartments. And door number three is short-term vacation rentals of the whole house,
sure.
mm-hmm. booked through somebody. And the Planning Commission opened door number one, and we've opened door number two, and we haven't yet opened door number three, though we know it's there. And I think the fact that you and others are testifying to it shows that we still have more work to do on this issue, even after we resolve the question of how do we deal with single-family homes, how do we deal with multifamily units. We have not yet written code.
Sure.
Or the Planning Commission hasn't even written a proposal about the third issue, but I think this hearing and the one before it have helped highlight the fact that this also is going on here and elsewhere. It's not currently legal. What do we want to do about it?
Understood. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Eric Schmidt. I guess I would also like to touch on door number three briefly.
Maybe I've set up a game show here.
Yeah. So in the fall of 2013, I was unexpectedly laid off from my job. For the first time in about 15 years, I found myself out of work without anything lined up. Very quickly found myself struggling with the current crowded job market. And I learned a harsh truth about Portland, and that is that the average wage for jobs is surprisingly low compared to the drastically higher rents and cost of living that we're experiencing. I was fortunate. I found Vacasa Rentals, and my period of unemployment was rather short. What I really would like to address is the possibility of economic growth through the potential of converting Portland homes into traditional short-term rentals. With the creation of those properties, the need for qualified maintenance staff, housekeeping, job opportunities for people in an ongoing basis in the industry that would provide steady, reliable jobs for people who may be struggling, like I was, to re-enter the workforce in a timely manner. Or people that want to advance in their current careers. Vacasa provides flexibility in our workforce with housekeepers, maintenance people, for the opportunity to go back to school, get education, take care of your kids, and not worry about where you're living and how you're going to pay the rent. To limit the legalization of vacation rentals to short-term rentals of rooms in a primary residence, I really feel like Portland would miss the opportunity to boost the local job market by allowing companies like Vacasa to create a new and reliable source of job opportunities for people at all levels of career development. By allowing companies to start creating jobs with competitive pay, the city is directly helping us to afford housing in this increasingly expensive rental market for long-term Portlanders so we can continue to stay in the city we love. I urge you to give consideration to expanding the parameters of what you're looking at.
Thank you. Thanks. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mayor and Commissioners. I'm going to be talking about promoting all three doors. So to start the short-term rental industry in Portland.
Just give us your name.
Diane.
Okay, thank
Diane
you.
Henderson. To start, the short-term rental industry in Portland should not be shaped by one type of rental alone, room shares, typically marketed on Airbnb. Over the past couple weeks, headlines controlling the media have been, quote, Portland City Council to vote on whether to legalize Airbnb rentals. Airbnb near deal with Portland over short-term rentals, sharing economy? Or how about Portland tries to make peace with Airbnb as sharing economy moves into the mainstream? And the list goes on. The conversation and vote should not be about the domination of Airbnb, but how the short-term vacation rental industry as a whole can benefit the great and unique city of Portland. To illustrate, I would like to share an experience of my cousin who stayed in Portland after accepting a job offer in downtown Portland, and why limiting the rules and regulations to room shares are curtailing the bigger picture. As an avid traveler and subsequent user of Airbnb and vacation rentals, my cousin knows the benefits of a space as a little slice of home in every travel experience, lauding the economic benefits of a private kitchen, bath, and private space. However, in Portland, under the current and proposed laws, what would he experience? Either A, a room or two in which negates the desire of privacy, or B, using a private condo or apartment illegally, or in my cousin's case, a converted office building, which was seemingly run as a downtown hotel, where the onus of regulation and safety are out of the guest's hands. I want to make this understood that I'm not advocating to get rid of room shares, as I do believe that room shares fulfills a market niche, but that's it, a niche. We are simply wishing to provide more options for consumers. The vacation rental industry proves that not every guest wants to stay in a cookie-cutter hotel. Consumers desire to live like a local, but in Portland, guests and tours are limited to the services and quality control of room shares alone. So thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you. Thank you all. Great.
The next three are Matthew Tesdall, Betsy LaBarge, and Judy Crockett. And they will be followed by Nicole Peltz, Deborah Imsey, and Alisa Christensen.
Okay. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
I think you're first, Matthew.
All right.
Figured out which one was Matthew.
Yeah. If I can't do that, you don't want me up here. Yeah.
Thank you for allowing us this time to speak. I'm Matthew Tesdall. My wife and I own a property management company that manages traditional short-term rentals, predominantly in Utah, but we live here in Oregon. We would like to, there's two things I want to point out. One is we'd like to operate here in Oregon, here in Portland. We love Portland. We actually live in Vernonia, but we would like to do it safely and honestly, and you know, like Vacasa was talking about. And I like the direction you guys are going. I was at the last meeting and earlier, June 4th, I think, and I like the direction you're going, but I'd like you to open up all doors, 1, 2, and 3, to people who have a home here, but for some reason don't live here anymore, whether it was a job transfer or something, but they intend to come back, and they need to make some revenue on that instead of just sitting here with it not making any revenue or doing long-term rental. That's number one. So I'd like to see all three doors open. Number two is we have 5 children. So my wife and I and our 5 children, we have been coming to Portland since 2001. We moved here 2 years ago. We could never stay in Portland because it's really difficult to stay in a hotel room with 5 kids or even 2 rooms. And so we always went to Mount Hood or Hood River or down into the Willamette area to stay. Instead, and even last week when we went on vacation for 4 or 5 days, we actually went to another city in Portland, in Oregon, and stayed there instead of staying in Portland. We're avid supporters of the Timbers Army and the Timbers soccer. So we would have loved to have stayed here, but we couldn't. We instead spent $2,000-$3,000 somewhere else. And it's just revenue I think the city is missing. That's all. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Welcome.
Okay. Well, thank you for your time. I'm Betsy LaBarge, and I own Mount Hood Vacation Rentals. I've been in business almost 23 years. I'm very actively involved in the short-term rental industry, and I've served on many boards nationally and locally, and I currently serve with Clackamas County Tourism Development Council, and I chair the marketing committee. And so to me, tourism development is very important, and the short-term rental industry is very important, especially the traditional short-term rental. And that is the door number 3 you mentioned. Maybe that's what we're going to start calling it, is door number 3. But it is really being ignored here, and that is a concern to me. If you look at the Airbnb listings, over 1,000 are entire home, which implies the host isn't there. So it is already happening, as you said, and not to say we should legalize everything that's already happening, except for this is a good type of activity. It does create a lot of economic benefit. We have the economic impact report that was done in 2013 for Portland, and it shows a lot of benefit, including, number one, the transient occupancy taxes that are not being collected now. City of Portland at 6%, Multnomah County at 5.5%, and the state of Oregon at 1%, and that's a lot of money that you're not getting. And until this regulation is well thought out and enforceable and covers that, there's a lot of income that's not being noticed by the municipalities. Secondly, I'm concerned that you're looking at only primary homes. There are a lot of examples where there could be a second home. One of my clients at Mount Hood also owns a condo as a second home in Portland, and he lives in Texas. He chooses to rent his home out at Mount Hood. He doesn't have an opportunity to rent his second home here. He does work full-time. It's not like he's here a lot, but he does come occasionally because he has kids in Portland, so they bought a second home in Portland. It would be a nice benefit for them to be able to rent it legally. And so I would really like to encourage you to consider how to include second homes in this and not make it just be primary homes. Other people have already talked about the economic benefit and, you know, the demographics of those people who rent, how much money they spend, $2,000-$3,000 on a vacation easily. And so we're missing that opportunity here. And I do just want to say thank you for looking at things like inspections and safety as a property manager for this many years. I'm always looking at that. And personally, I would love to have the professional inspector come tell me, back me up. So I'm not the one who's saying, yeah, that railing is safe, that deck is safe, that electrical is safe, because that's what I do now. Nobody's telling me that I'm right, but I think I am. I mean, I don't know. So I really applaud you for taking a deeper look at a lot of those issues that you were questioning in the last public hearing a month ago. And I also will volunteer my time to be of any assistance to you. I've been actively involved in this for 22 years, served nationally on boards. Please call on me. I'm happy to help you find connections.
And I should say this to anyone, make sure our staff has your contact info, if they don't already.
Which staff person would that be?
Behind you, the two right there, Susan Anderson and Sandra.
They're going to get a bunch of business cards.
Because we are going to need to draw on the industry to figure this out. So thank you. Good afternoon.
Mr. Mayor, Commissioners, my name is Judy Crockett, and I live in close-in southeast Portland, and I'm here supporting the proposed changes. I retired from the city about 6 years ago, and in that time period, the cost of living has gone up 10%, as has my property tax, and my pensions have not kept up with that. And renting out one room in my home has been very useful, not only in making up that gap, but also allowing me to make changes and improvements to my home. For example, this last year, I had the home, which is even older than I am, attached to its foundations so that it would be safer in terms of an earthquake. Two of my neighbors, Mrs. Gallucci and Mrs. Carlson, lived in their homes until they were either in their mid-90s or, in Mrs. Gallucci's case, 102. Before this last year, they both moved into the same nursing home. I'd like to be able to do that very same thing in my neighborhood. I have been renting out with Airbnb for 3 years, and when I began looking at it, I tried to comply with every possible regulation short of spending $4,000 to get a zoning change. I put in easy access, easy exit windows. I put in a CO2 monitor, extra fire alarms. I did everything that I possibly could, got more insurance, got my food handler's license, so I can provide a nice experience for the guests as well as a really great breakfast. In addition, every year I've spent about an extra $2,000 of buying supplies and food for the guests, so I am hopefully pumping a little bit of money into the economy. I think I would love to be able to come out and be operating legally, and I have no problem with paying taxes. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
The next three are Nicole Peltz, Deborah Imsey, and Alyssa Christensen. And they'll be followed by Albert Dormeyer, Rosemary Brown, and Jeff Reingold.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Am I first?
Sure. Go ahead.
Hi. My name is Alyssa Christensen. I moved to Portland in 06 after being injured in Los Angeles. I was burned and had brain damage, so That's why I speak slow and with a stutter, so please excuse me. I'll try to be concise. I started in Los Angeles, is a huge metropolis. There's a lot of burn support. When I moved up here, there was only one burn unit for the whole state and no burn support. So I started Portland Burn Survivors, a not-for-profit dedicated to helping burn survivors get back on their feet and for their friends and family, too, because burns take so long to heal. And with my income is fixed since I was in a union when I was injured. I'm getting my pension early, and so I have enough money to live on myself, but I don't have enough money to fund my corporation. So what I do is, instead of attaching my Social Security number to the MasterCard that Airbnb pays me through, I attached Portland Burn Survivors EIN. So now we have money to give burn survivors that say, call me up and I can't pay my mortgage this month. Can you do anything for me? I can say yes. They call me up and saying I haven't been able to pay my phone bill for 3 months. It's going to get shut off. Can you pay it? I can say yes. So for that reason alone, I think you should really, really consider this. And as far as taxes go, I paid $3,000 in tax when I first bought my house. 7 years later, I'm paying over $4,600. I pay enough in taxes, and I really don't think that we should pay more. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for what you're doing. Thank you. Deborah, welcome.
Good to be here. Good afternoon, Mayor Hales and commissioners. My name is Deborah Imsey, and I am the executive director for Multifamily Northwest. Our members represent over 180,000 units of rental housing. As City Council considers short-term rental issues, it's critical that landlord-tenant law, long-term lease agreements, and affordable housing issues are understood and addressed in both single-family and multifamily units. The lease is the heart of landlord-tenant law and covers the rights and obligations of both the resident and the landlord. Most leases prohibit subletting or running a commercial business in the unit. In short, it's the rule rather than the exception that renters are not allowed to do those two activities. It's critical that the city not mislead prospective permit applicants about their ability to do these short-term rentals or appear to allow an activity that is not permitted by another contract. I realize that the short-term rentals like Airbnb may be are going on currently in rental units where the lease prohibits it. The reality is that our members get complaints all the time. What we don't know is how many of those complaints are non-paying guests, which are allowed, and how many are generated by a prohibited short-term rental. The question has been asked over the last few days a lot. Why delay consideration for multifamily properties? Frankly, because multifamily housing simply has not been at the table and has not had the same vetting and public process as the single-family structures, as it was removed from consideration early on in the process. Multifamily Northwest urges the council to adopt some protections for the single-family units that will be legal. One, no permit application should be accepted unless the owner agent approves. No inspection should be scheduled unless the owner agent authorizes it. And short-term rental sites should commit that they will not list any rental unless a permit has been issued. With these owner protections in place for single-family rentals over the next 2 years, everyone will be able to get some real data on what works, what needs improvement, and what unintended consequences need addressing before we take on the more complicated issues of multifamily rentals. We need to look at this 2016 report. Thank you for your consideration of our concerns, and I look forward to working with you as you make your decisions on short-term rental policy.
So, Deborah, I think from our standpoint, I might need to bring staff up and talk about this, but our code in terms of land use doesn't really make a distinction between a condominium building and an apartment building.
it's different from a legal standpoint, but take a piece of CXD property downtown. You can build a building on it that has a bunch of housing units, and you can either rent them out or you can sell them. And, in fact, you could start doing one and then change your mind and start doing something else. So I think from a land use standpoint, one of the reasons why we are interested in opening door number two, if I could go back to my silly metaphor, is that we're just trying to decide, should we enable the transaction to happen legally? In order for it to happen legally in an apartment building, we're proposing that the owner of the apartment also be involved in the decision, obviously. And in the case of a condominium, that the homeowners association also be involved, because in each case, the occupant of that multifamily building has a contract with somebody else. If I'm a condo owner, I have a contract with my condo association. If I'm a renter, I have a contract with my landlord. The proposal in front of us tries to respect that relationship. I hope you agree. And so waiting to deal with the buildings that are in a city that's becoming more dense, waiting to deal with the buildings that have more than one unit in them seems a strange option to me. So if we're able to get that basic protection for the lease, which we think we have here, if you want a permit to have to operate a short-term rental in your apartment unit, you have to have your landlord's approval. We think we've checked that box, but help me more with that.
I'd be happy to. I mean, I think that right now we're saying for our – so we have members that are with one unit, mom and pop, all the way up to 18,000 units. So what we're saying is we haven't – we're putting something on the table that we don't even know is going to work yet. It isn't – it, you know, we need to take a look and see what are the outcomes in a much more restricted way. For instance, on a single-family home, that – address gets posted on Portland Maps. When you have a unit that is doing this, that doesn't get posted on Portland Maps. We have a lot of issues around, for instance, the tax credit property. They have to affirm their income. So if they affirm their income and they're also getting this other income over here, they're out of balance. When you rent an apartment, you sign probably 20 documents. What we are seeing happen already is this discussion is leading people to think that this is something that they will be able to do, when in most cases they won't be able to do. That having been said, why not vet all the issues that might come up and then develop a policy, if in fact a policy should be developed?
Eric, can I pose
sure,
a few questions?
Please.
And Deborah serves. You still serve on the Housing Advisory Commission,
Portland Housing Bureau, yeah.
And so, I in my experience working with Metro Multifamily, for example, colleagues, we've had some sharp disagreements in the past. Or put it this way, there are times when I would not want to walk in Deborah's shoes because her caucus has sharp disagreements on issues, whether it's Section 8 or fair housing or whatever. So, what I can say is that when we've taken the time to work through these issues, we've usually gotten to the right place. We would not have had Section 8 reform or progress in fair housing without the industry standing side by side. And we didn't always start at the same place, but at the end we got there. So, Deborah, walk us through your view of, we have an amendment that's on the table that says this would be allowed if the landlord, in the case of multifamily rental housing, signed off on it. Is it likely that a landlord, and you've previously said that most of these leases have at least one, if not two, express prohibitions, no commercial activity, no subletting. So it's already baked into the lease agreements, you can't do it. Under what circumstances can you imagine a landlord agreeing to this transaction? And two, is there a possibility that in agreeing to the transaction, the landlord could attempt to exact new terms and conditions for the lease agreement?
So I could see a situation, and some were mentioned here, where a landlord has a small, 10 unit, and they're living in that unit, and they want to make a decision to rent out you know, a couple of those units, and they may have long-term renters as well. And so in that case, you're talking about the owner, that's fine. There's no problem in that. So that's an arrangement that I could see as a possibility, because the owner is allowing, and maybe if they have short-term rentals there, maybe they don't care if their residents have short-term rentals as well. I don't see the liability for multifamily property. I do not see a situation in which a landlord would go along with that program. You're talking about other residents that entered into leases expecting that they were going to be in a, have the quiet, safe enjoyment of their building, and now people that haven't been screened are coming into their area, sharing their common area, and that's not what the other tenants signed on for.
So, additionally, have you had a chance since this conversation started, this debate, to look at the experience of other cities, and have you learned anything about other cities that is that you believe should guide our deliberation?
Well, I think that we need to look at some more experience, but I, because nobody's had a lot of experience, and Portland is frankly on the leading edge of trying to have some regulation around this issue. But I will say that San Francisco has serious concerns about this situation depleting the availability of affordable housing, because people are taking their units off the market and just doing short-term rentals.
For another issue of concern to me and anything that we regulate is to make sure that our regulation, our ability to enforce regulations, that we have the ability to enforce our regulations. We can spend all day crafting sensible regulations, but if we can't enforce them, then we got a problem. So we've heard from a lot of people who have come before us saying that they are renting out their apartment. So apparently there's a lot of people in Portland in violation of their lease. To what extent is the industry taking steps to police that? Or are you unable to police that?
Well, it is not easy to police because of, you know, what I just, you know, said about the unit not being listed on Portland maps. I will tell you that, like the city of Portland, this is a new issue for my members, a recognition that some of what's going on in the property may, in fact, be prohibited by the lease. And we've had some discussions. We have a board meeting in a couple of weeks in which this is the topic of how we are going to regulate it. It is a serious enough offense in violation of the lease that they will either stop it or they will be evicted. And frankly, my members are in the business of renting. They're not in the business of evicting and don't want to be in that business.
So I think the basic disagreement I may have with this amendment is the mayor's offered is that I think my preference is we pull industry together, spend 6 months discussing this, brainstorming, looking at the issues, seeing if we should if it can be regulated effectively, and come back to council for that discussion. The mayor's approach would be essentially saying we're going to allow this as of January 1st and then spend the next 6 months working out the details. Do you have a strong view of either approach?
Well, I believe the preference that we would have is that we sit down, collaborate in a room, iron out all the issues, the possible concerns around liability. It concerns me that Oregon On, that represents all our nonprofits in the state, hasn't been in a room to weigh in on this to see what impact it would have on the affordable housing side of the equation, when we know that at least in San Francisco that's been a concern. So I'm happy to roll up my sleeves and work hard to try to take a look at all these issues and see if it makes sense for the city of Portland. And, I mean, I'm all for the economic viability of our city as well, but I just want to make sure that we're putting together good public policy that one of the gentlemen was up here. It says people look to Portland and look to Austin as samples of where good policy is made, and I'd like to make sure that this is one of those times when we're making good policy.
And finally, Mayor, I appreciate the dispensation just to make a record. You said Oregon on. One of the things that concerns me is that I can think of a dozen contexts in which there's rental housing, but because of the funding source for developing the housing, there's a different set of rules. So there are different sets of rules around Section 8. There are different sets of rules around tax credit. There's different sets of rules around public housing. There's different sets of rules around housing done by Habitat with different pots of money. You can go on and on. And what appears on the surface to be a question of multifamily, to me, is a very complicated question. And there are equitable issues there about who can and can't take advantage of this if we allow it. And so it's one of the reasons why, I'm just speaking for myself, I feel we have a substantial record here to decide how this applies to single family. I feel like we're flying blind in the multifamily. There may be a path forward on multifamily, but I would like to see the same care and attention to building a record on that issue that we had with the single family, because I'm actually at a point where I feel very comfortable moving forward with a single family. I think the record gives us some clarity about regulation. So I appreciate. Do you have any members in your association who have indicated to you that they are interested in exploring a change in what's been the traditional practice of prohibiting this kind of activity and move to one where it would be either allowed or encouraged?
So, no, I don't. In fact, I had a lot of alarm bells. The closest that we do have a member that does do short-term renting for corporate and some other situations, and they handle it just like they would a long-term renter. That person's screened, a background check is done, and their recommendation would be that any time you're putting somebody in a property where you don't have a background check would be inappropriate.
Well, Deborah, I've got to say, first of all, we're not in a court of law. We're not here to build a record. We're here to make common sense decisions in real time about things that are already happening. So, secondly, as both a former representative of the Multifamily Housing Council and as a landlord, I'm frankly puzzled that you don't want us to do this for now. That is, this is illegal today. It might also be in violation of people's leases today, or there might be landlords. In fact, I don't have a provision in my lease that prohibits this. I don't plan to. But I'm perfectly free to do that today, and I'll be perfectly free to do that the morning after this ordinance goes into effect. And in fact, I will also have the city of Portland with an open and fairly clear registration program for people that want to do this that requires my signature. So why wouldn't, as a landlord, why wouldn't I want the city to do that? I'm just puzzled by your position that, sure, we might refine this more later, but wouldn't a good starting place be doing what we have in front of us now, which is to say, of course we're not invading your lease. Of course we're not invading your homeowners association agreement. But if you have a tenant who wants to rent out their second bedroom, they have to check with you first, prove that they've checked with you, and then get a permit from the city. Why wouldn't you want us to do that for now?
Well, the reason I wouldn't want you to do it for now is I'm not convinced that it should be done at all. So until the conversations that need to happen and until we know what the unintended consequences of the policy might be, and rather putting it in place today and then dealing with the fallout sounds much more difficult for my members than walking through the process knowing, as Commissioner Fish mentioned, there are a lot of different, there are affordable housing contracts that won't ever allow this.
Sure, then prohibit it. Then say, you can't do that in this
right.
unit.
And I think I and other landlord associations would like the opportunity to figure out what those all are so we can educate both our members and our residents on what they can do and can't do. And if it goes into play immediately, there is no education for a very complex process.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I go back to my experience on Section 8 and fair housing, where actually I had a philosophical disagreement with Metro Multifamily on some level. And we worked through those issues to get to a consensus. And the industry came along and it developed best practices along the way. And that, I think we're talking six of one, half dozen. I don't actually see a fundamental issue here other than we spent a lot of time having an administrative body look at something, consider the intended, unintended consequences, develop guidelines. We had a work session. We've had two public hearings. We've had amendments. And that has produced, in my opinion, in the area of single-family residence, a thoughtful record upon which to act. I don't feel the record before us is sufficient to start making bets about what might or might not work with multifamily, and which is why I think we should take a time out, spend the time to study it, come back with a proposal that would hopefully have the blessing of your industry. We may still do it over your objection, but my experience with Metro Multifamily is we usually get to the right place at the end.
Yep. I had a couple of questions. One is, I mean, do you think it is true that there's a fair amount of this going on now?
You know, I guess it's what's fair amount. The last number I heard was that there were 1,500 listings, and I think it's, I mentioned to some of you, and I'll mention it again, the documents that they have to sign, I'm guessing that there are folks out there that don't know their lease prohibits it and are, in fact, doing it.
And, I mean, have there been, to date, a bunch of evictions for people breaking their lease by doing this?
Well, this is very new to our radar screen. So the answer is I don't think that there has been a lot of evictions as it relates to this issue, because I don't think a lot of members, as I mentioned in testimony, it would be difficult to know whether or not it was a guest that had caused the problem, or, you know, they're not going to say, you know, this was my illegal thing I was doing. If there's a problem or a complaint, it's going to be handled in terms of the resident, not the guest or the short-term rental.
You're right. 1,500 sounds like a lot, but I guess it is limited. I mean, it seems to me that if this were a widespread practice already, then you should have seen a surge in complaints about unwanted people on properties and already seen some evictions.
Yes. You know, I think it would have, I'm guessing, Commissioner, it would have been on our radar screen if earlier, if that was the case. BDS says 25% of single-family homes are rentals. I mean, there some piece of that 1,500 is obviously single-family homes.
So, I mean, is it your concern, I mean, if what's going on now hasn't really bubbled to the surface as a major issue for your members, is your concern really that if the city puts its imprimatur in this practice, then there will be a big surge in the number of people doing it, and that might cause problems you
Absolutely.
Haven't seen to date?
Absolutely.
And is I mean, is this advanced enough? And I mean, in the places that have decided to start recognizing and regulating this, has there been do we know if there's been an acceleration in the number of people doing it, or was it just sort of the same kind of growth in places that aren't authorizing it as in places that are?
I don't have that data. I could get it for you and see if it's out there.
Okay. Thank you, Deborah. Appreciate it. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mayor Hales, Commissioners. My name is Nicole Pelz, and I just want to say that I love, love, love Portland. I've been here for 34 years, and I love sharing my enthusiasm and my love for Portland with Airbnb people. I live in Selwood, and all I can say is I've had nothing but positive experiences for the past 3 years. But I'm not here for that. I'm here because this woman, who's also an Airbnb renter, couldn't be here, and she asked me to read her testimony. Her name's Judy Cox, and I'll be fast. I am a recently widowed woman living on $1,100 Social Security per month, my only income until Airbnb saved me from homelessness and complete destitution. All our savings from selling our house were gobbled up with medical bills in the past 2 years. When my husband died, I found I had less than a third of the income because I had just my Social Security or his, not a combination. Also, his pension stopped when he passed away. Enter Airbnb. I have never enjoyed and experienced so much. I'm no longer so lonely. I can afford to have enough food to live on, and I can pay for my two-bedroom apartment. I have met the most interesting, intelligent, sweet, courteous people who are helping our economy by frequenting Powell's bookstore, restaurants, food carts, breweries, coffee places, voodoo donuts, Saturday market. Not to mention the money I receive is funneled back into the community, and I am not living off welfare, and I'm pulling my weight to make this community better. It is discriminatory to decide that apartments and condos should not be allowed to host guests for Airbnb. There's absolutely no difference from my quiet, soundproof apartment, and all my guests are wonderful about respecting my neighbors and are quiet and unintrusive. Then she gives a couple